Welcome to Entanglement Radio, transcendent talk for the conscious mind. Join us for inspiring conversations with visionaries in spiritual science, new thought, and conscious healing. Explore the potential and infinite possibilities of what it means to be human with some of the best guests in radio. At Entanglement Radio, it is all connected. Now, here is your host, Angela Levesque, on the Om Times Radio Network.
Times Radio Network. I'm really excited for our show today. It's a little bit of a departure from our regular conversation, which I think is always good. We have Matt Barisi on the program today, and we were talking about the subject of his book, Dead White Guys, A Father, His Daughter, and the Great Books of the Western World. So we are talking about some of the great thinkers who really did shape our Western civilization. So I cannot think of a more important conversation to have. Coming up next week, we have the Blue Collar Goddess on, Sarah Nash, and we are just, it's going to just be in an open flow conversation. Conversations from the brink is what I called it. I think we need to have some of these conversations, as we'll talk a little bit about today as well. We need to open our minds and get over ourselves and really have some, I think we have some important conversations to have. So we'll be doing that. And then I'll be following that up with Don Miguel Ruiz, of course, the author of The Four Agreements will be on. So we're really excited about that. If you need to get a hold of me at any time during the week, you can email me at angela@hestiahealth.com. You can find me on Facebook and on Twitter at Hestia Health and Entanglement Radio. And if you want to know about my upcoming program, Inspired and Empowered, you can go to hestiahealth.com and learn more about how we connect to our purpose and activate our potential. So let me introduce my guest. Matt Barisi is the author of Dead White Guys, A Father, His Daughter, and the Great Books of the Western World, and Nonprofit, which won an AWP award for the novel. He is currently the executive director of Providence. The name, I don't know how to pronounce that, we'll ask them, and a library and cultural institution dedicated to the advancement of humanities. He began his career at the Tony Award-winning Chicago Shakespeare Theater on Navy Pier and later served as executive director for both the Association of Writers and Writing Programs and the Penn Faulkner Foundation. During his tenure at AWP, he helped build the largest literary conference in North America, and he served as a national advocate for literature and the humanities. In his work as a consultant, he has interviewed dozens of global leaders in healthcare, scientific research, and higher education. With that, I feel very honored and blessed to welcome Matt Barisi to the program. How you doing, Matt?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
I fumbled through that a little bit. So tell me, what is the name? You are currently the ED of, what is that?
I'm the executive director of the Providence Athenaeum.
Athenaeum. All right. I tried to practice that before we got on air, and then just I was like, I'm looking at it, and I don't know how to say that. So
it's a word. It's a word we don't use that much anymore, but it means Temple of Athena.
Yes. Okay. So you know what? I interview a lot of self-help gurus on this program, and I never ask the question, why did you write this book? But I'm going to ask you this question because I find it very relevant and I think important. So you wrote the book, Dead White Guys. Tell us a little bit about why you did that.
So there were a lot of reasons why I wrote the book, but the most immediate one was the birth of my daughter, Violet, which was quite traumatic. At the time, I was at AWP and I was in Denver giving a speech there, literally on stage when I got the news. What happened was my wife started bleeding to death. She was 7 months pregnant and she had to be rushed to the hospital. And I had to rush across the country to get back to Washington, D.C. to be with her. And I got a picture of my daughter, I remember, before I got on the plane. And it was really horrific, actually. It was a picture of her, and she was, you know, covered with tubes and wires and everything. And that was the last thing I knew before I got to Washington. And so it was one of those life events that sort of grabs you by the throat and makes you view life a lot differently. And at the time Violet was born, it was 2010. Everything in my life was a complete mess. I was a mess. I was having a career crisis. My house was underwater. And I was living in DC, which is the capital of this global empire that was also a mess. I mean, the economy had collapsed. and we were in two disastrous wars. We were losing both of them. And then I remember my dad asked me, I was raised Roman Catholic, and my dad asked me when I was going to baptize Violet. And I had this thought, I remember, I'd really like to baptize Violet, but I don't want anyone to molest her. And it's not, I know, but it sounds horrible. It wasn't anything about my history, but, and then I thought, what a terrible thing to think. And then I thought, geez, my little girl sitting here, you know, and she's in this box, doctors are caring for her, but she's going to grow up in this environment where all the civic, economic, and spiritual systems that were supposed to support her all seem to have entered this decadent collapse. It was just, I was just really worried about it. So I guess the main driver of the book was to sort of replace my experience going to church with something else, but instead of sermons, I would give her questions. And as I learned about these books myself, I really had a personal epiphany of my own. And it was, it really changed my life in a very dramatic way.
Do you care to share that epiphany with us?
Well, there's a lot there. I mean, you know, I'll start here. I was working as an advocate for higher education, and I was working with humanities programs around the country, writing programs to be specific. And one of the things I read, one of the editors of the great books of the Western world was a man named Robert Maiden Hutchins. And he wrote this book in the 50s called The University of Utopia. And while I was researching the book, I read it. And I came across this statement he wrote, and it was this: the object of the educational system, taken as a whole, is not to produce hands for industry or teach the young how to make a living. It is to produce responsible citizens. And that, to me, was the most profound and radical statement on the goal of education that I had ever read. It's completely contrary to what our policymakers on both sides of the aisle believe. It's completely opposite to the work I was doing in education, where I was making the economic argument for writing and for the humanities in general. And so whenever I hear Obama knock art history, or I hear Marco Rubio talk about how we don't need more philosophers, or Jeb Bush knocks the liberal arts, this argument is what they're both embracing. This is the only thing that both political parties agree on, is that the only point of education is to prepare you to get a job. And there's a significant problem with that worldview, in my opinion. And that is that we are, another thing Hutchins wrote in this book was, if we survive, he was writing in the 50s, so it's filled with this specter of nuclear Armageddon. He said, if we survive, we are going to live in a wantless, workless society. The machines will do the work. And he saw this 70 years ago. And it comports with a lot of things that are happening now in the economy. We're facing a paradigm shift in the way our economic model is working. My daughter is not going to need to be a technician. The machines will be the technicians. You know, she's going to have to be a participant in a conversation in which we change the paradigm, how our economic and political system is actually built. And I really think you're seeing the first stages of that conversation when you see, look at what happened last night in New Hampshire. You have the ultimate plutocrat on one side, and then on the other side, you've got a democratic socialist who nobody thought would ever go anywhere in this race. And so the argument is happening. It's just starting to happen, but and I think it's going to evolve and continue. And what the real challenge is that we're trying to cram a system that was built for the Industrial Revolution into a technological period where those rules no longer apply.
Yeah. Oh, so you brought up so many things that I want to, we are definitely going to get into politics and the role of government, and we're going to get there for sure. I think that, oh my goodness, this is such an important conversation, especially looking at the results from last night. I hope you're, can we just get over that? Are you a Trump supporter? Okay. Cause,
no, of course not.
Okay. I was really thinking you wouldn't be, but you know, I don't understand it, but we'll get to that. We'll get to that. I want to talk about this responsible citizen piece because, you know, my son is 8 years old and we've brought in Common Core, and before we had Bush with No Child Left Behind. And you're right. It's like, there should be no point. Our focus should be on the STEM, on science, technology, mathematics, engineering. That is it. And to me, that is such a loss of life. There is so much richness, not even just in human history, but right now, to develop within our human beings, our souls, whatever, however mystical you want to get it, that if we don't talk about literature and drama and artistic endeavors, that we are missing. Who wants to live in that world? I certainly don't.
Yeah, well, we're really approaching a world that Plato described in the Republic. I mean, it's you know, and he was being tongue in cheek about it, but it's a world in which you know, we're just all fitting, we're cogs in a machine, basically. And our education is only now so useful as long as that machine remains functioning. But once it becomes obsolete, our education is obsolete too.
You know, when I took my undergrad in kinesiology, and I took a lot of electives in philosophy, and my academic advisor would say, you know, I can't tell you what electives you should take, but she said, I don't see a point in you learning philosophy. It's not in alignment with, and I was like, these are the questions of humanity, of our existence, of our governments, of our financial systems, everything, like of our culture. And if you start to understand the culture, you start to understand the individual. And you might not think that that has anything to do with helping them eat better or move their bodies, but it has everything to do with that. And she, and even now, and I didn't appreciate this back then, but when you now start to get people asking those questions, and maybe they're not studying happiness from Aristotle's point of view, but they're understanding, thinking about happiness from their own point of view. They're thinking about why we're here. Is there, a right and a wrong? And those kind of conversations, that's where you get people excited about their lives. That's where you get them thinking about healthier choices, because all of a sudden their life has much more meaning than, you know, what the Kardashians are doing. So right. What would you have said to my academic advisor?
I would say that really now I think everybody needs to learn philosophy. I think it's critical. And really what you're seeing in this presidential debate, the reason why I brought it up is not because I'm really, you know, it's fascinating to me to see what's going to happen in this whole thing. But the real question that's at stake between those two individuals specifically is, what is the fair distribution of resources? That's a big question. That's a philosophical question. That's a question that can't be answered by some soundbite or some formula. You have to talk about justice. You have to talk about equality. You have to talk about equity. It's very, you know, it's a very philosophical issue.
And, you know, humans, we're talking about the Zika virus and people are out there, let's just kill the mosquitoes. We don't think about them. These are the questions we need to have, the big questions. So when we get back, I want to talk about the polarization of our conversation, especially around politics, but around finances, everything. It's all interrelated. So we'll talk about that more when we return here with Matt Barisi on Integument.
Your conscious connection to a more mindful world. Om Times Radio. IOM FM. Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. OM Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single OM Times endeavor. Host your show with OM Times Radio Network.
Hello, I'm Miriam Knight of New Consciousness Review, inviting you to my new show where I interview the rising stars of the conscious awakening. We'll explore the many faces of consciousness and action and intriguing perspectives on life, the universe, and everything in between. Join us each Wednesday at 2 p.m. Eastern on the Rising Stars Show.
Hello, I'm Sandy Sedgemeer, host of the Inspired Parenting Radio Show, where every week we bring you empowering information from the diverse fields of conscious parenting, education, neuroscience, consciousness, health, and metaphysics to support you in nurturing the best in your children. So if you're interested in understanding what shapes your children's minds, spirits, and hearts, join me every Thursday at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and prepare to be inspired.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle. Bringing a more conscious lifestyle to your world. OM Times Radio, IOM FM.
to Entanglement Radio with Angela Levesque right here on the OM Times Radio Network. If you're just joining us, we have Dead White Guys author Matt Barisi on, and we are talking about philosophy and just the origins of our Western civilization. Just that, you know, nothing more. Pretty important stuff. I wanted to ask you before we get into the politics of it all and the role of government, because I know that that's going to take up a big chunk of time. You know, the things that these great thinkers, what they were writing, eventually translated, like we've talked about, into our economic system, into our, you know, the our government. There's so many things. Do you think that the philosophers of the modern philosophers, we're going to be looking at their thinking, you know, to help us structure our world 100, 500, 1,000 years from now? Or do you think that they have become irrelevant or extinct or unimportant?
No, I think they're extremely relevant. Actually, there's a philosopher named Nick Bostrom working at Oxford. I think he's working at Oxford, who has a fascinating proof of God, and it's called the simulation argument. And it's I think he's extremely relevant. And I think that we're going to be looking to philosophers to sort of lay out the ground rules for what the new system should look like. I think they're going to be crucial in that endeavor.
Well, so. I hope so. But I bet, you know, I was watching some late night show and where it's look at how dumb Americans are. And it's actually pretty easy to prove that point. But they were asking like college students, like who won the Civil War, who's our vice president. And, you know, of course, I'm sure they were selective in the sound bites they picked. But it was just like, I don't even, and I'm speaking for myself, I don't know that I could name a current day philosopher. I could name probably up to the 50s, a lot of the early 1900s, but I'm not sure that I could even name a modern day philosopher.
Yeah, I mean, some of that is because, you know, in hindsight, everybody looks better and more important than maybe they did at
true.
The time. But, you know, with some of the, I think the interesting work in philosophy right now is really being done in the realm of artificial intelligence and the implications for what that means for us as a society. So Bostrom's one of them. I would put Ray Kurzweil in that camp, who is he's a head of Google, has an interesting argument about the singularity, which is fascinating. But I think that's where the interesting work is being done right now. Now, the question none of those philosophers seem to be asking that I can find is, okay, so we're going to have all this abundance and machines are going to do everything. How is it going to work as a society? And you're starting to see some talk about universal basic income and those kinds of concepts coming up. So I think that's where the interesting work is being done. And I think in hindsight, people will be grateful for those people.
Well, as you're saying that, I'm thinking, thank God somebody's thinking about that stuff. Because if you look at what's being presented to us on the television, 24-hour news cycles, even just if you listen to talk radio, it seems like we are stuck in this gridlock of, you know, this guy, you know, Hillary does this and the left and the right, and there's no conversation that it's like, okay, well, at some point we're going to need to have, you know, some civil discourse about this and really think about it instead of pointing fingers and, you know, just this creating this divisiveness. And so I'm glad that there's people outside of this political arena that are having these conversations. How do we bring them into our pop culture, into our collective consciousness, so that people, it's not just like for the thinkers out there.
Well, it's going to be a challenge. So there's significant challenges, and there's significant challenges with incorporating this kind of thinking into our everyday life. And I think it's all structural. I mean, the first challenge is getting over the consumerist mentality in America that seems to have gripped every sector of our economy. There's a reason why we believe these things, but you know, and I'll get into this a little bit, is that it used to be in the classical world, the model was that, as Aristotle famously said, man is a political animal. And what he meant by that was that the political system was paramount and that everything else served the political system, the state. And that was the economy and you know, everything was in service to the highest form of man, which is the state. That was where you have a civic republic. We're living in a liberal republic because what happened was John Locke came along and said, no, he's got it the wrong way around. Really, man is an economic animal. And so now the economy becomes supreme and politics serves the economy. And so when we hear things like, and I heard this in higher education all the time, we hear students referred to as consumers or customers. We hear patients referred to as customers or consumers of healthcare. And we hear our government talked about in terms of the, in those kinds of terms, where we talk about, you know, we vote in the marketplace of ideas, and you know, we need our government to be run like a business. This is all because we have this, everything is about consumption and consumerism, and we have not accepted that there is any value other than a monetary value. And that is a difficult societal problem to get around.
Yes, it absolutely is. And there's so much distraction going on that just feeds into that system. So you watch things on television, and then there's commercials, and then there's more distraction, and there's more promotion of consumerism. And I don't know where we implement those system interrupts, like where we put them and say, hey, pay attention, pay attention.
Well, I mean, it's a pipeline issue. It's got to start with education. I think with Sanders, you're really seeing it. I think what's happening in the political discourse is that the choices are getting starker. We can argue about whether or not you agree with Bernie Sanders, but the policies that he's proposing are not actually that radical from a Western perspective. They've been embraced in many Western countries, but they're radical here. They're very radical here. And so I think Obama moved the conversation to the left. Sanders is pushing it more to the left. And I think that the current the generation that's now coming up is going to push it much more to the left.
Well, you know, if I look at the whole, all the options out there right now, I'm actually Canadian, so it's kind of a moot point because I can't vote here anyway, but I'm still very interested. I would probably be voting for Bernie if I was able to vote here. And the reason being is, well, Hillary to me is just, she has zero moral character. And I don't feel like she, I just don't. And I feel the same way about Trump. To me, he's just like fly by night. Whatever somebody wants him to say, he just says. I think he's quite smart about what he's doing, but it's still, it's, there's no ethical, moral, spiritual center to either of those candidates. And so I like Bernie, and people are just, they're afraid of Bernie. But the thing that I have issue with is his idea of fairness. Yes, things are not fair, but I think when we talk about fairness, it really creates victims. And I don't think we need victims right now. I think we need people who are empowered. But there is his sentiment behind what he's – there is fundamental flaws in the way that our system is as of now. And I think that that goes back to your conversation about how we have industrial thinking in an information age. And I think that that's a problem. But I enjoy that what he's bringing to the table. What I don't enjoy – is us not being able to have a real conversation without scare tactics and hyperbole and, you know, ooh, socialism is the devil. It's a sliding slope to communism. And so how do we – first, okay, I want to let you respond to that and then talk a little bit more how we move past that.
I'm sorry, you broke up.
Oh, I just – how do we –
I can't hear you.
Oh, you can't hear me. Let's see. Can you hear me now? What I'm going to do is go ahead and hang up and then add you back. So I would like to hear his response to that conversation, because I think that's what we need to think about here is, let me see, I need to add him back into the program. Because part of the
issue.
Hello.
Sorry about that.
We have you back. So,
yep.
I don't know at what point you cut out there, but I want to invite you to respond to this idea about, you know, how we move out of the divisiveness, how we can have this conversation about, yes, he's a democratic socialist, and yet not go into that place of fear or hyperbole.
Well, I mean, unfortunately, I think at this point, we almost had that conversation after 2007. We were close to having it after the financial collapse. But if it happens again and we're forced with another kind of financial crisis, I think there's going to be a real re-examination of how we're doing things. And I hate to say that, but I think that's what's going to prompt the conversation. I don't think it's going to come out of the political debate. I honestly don't.
Hmm. And I'm not sure if you heard the part about me saying that the thing that I agree with Bernie in a lot of ways, and I think that he will take the conversation where we need to go, but I don't connect with his message of things being unfair, because I don't think life is fair. And I do think that there's fundamental flaws in our system that we need to address, but when we talk about it from a place of fairness, we create a bunch of victims. And I don't think that we can move from a place of victimhood. I think we need to really think about what it is we want, the way we like to set up our world, and move towards that and fix some of the glaring obstacles to us achieving that. But how do you feel about his conversation around fairness?
Well, I would agree with that when you talk about the word fairness. I would say that of all the political candidates, and this is not an endorsement of Bernie Sanders, but one of the most fascinating things to me is that Bernie Sanders, to my mind, is the only candidate who said the word justice at all, mm-hmm. who thought justice was an issue that should be a discussion of presidential politics. And that's very interesting because, well, isn't this important? Isn't justice as a concept important to the Republic? And the same thing is true of things like virtue and character and courage. These are words you never hear in a presidential debate. But those are the words we need to be thinking about, I think. An issue of fairness, you know, life is unfair, and this is an interesting question now about victims and victimhood. But justice, I think, should be our pursuit as a civilized republic.
Yes, I agree that justice should be our pursuit. And so then when you have people like Trump who are saying, we're just going to build walls and we're going to, you know, torture people and do whatever.
That's one way to go.
Do whatever we need to do to make America great again. That to me is the antithesis of that conversation around justice. It's
well, that's right, because the conversations are getting starker. I think they're getting more polarized. I think there's a reason for that. And what's interesting to me about Trump was he had an interview with Chuck Todd, and Chuck Todd didn't even know how to deal with him because Trump was saying we should have gone into Iraq and then just taken all the oil to get something out of it. And it was a pretty stark declaration of imperialism.
I could use a few other choice words, but I will not. Okay. When we get back, I want to talk about, you use the word republic and not democracy. And I want to explore the difference between the two, because many people think we live in a democratic nation. So we'll talk about that more when we return here with Matt Barisi on Entangment Radio. We'll be right back.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Host your show on IOM FM, the radio network of Om Times Media, one of the more recognized brand names in the conscious community, and is backed by the extensive marketing reach of Om Times. Hosting a show on IOM FM immediately connects you with our extensive, dedicated community.
Do you want to be a better communicator? Do you want to better connect with the important people in your life? Do you want to enrich your relationships? If so, join me, Matthew Cooper, on the Positive Control System show every Wednesday evening at 11 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Om Times Radio. I'll meet you there.
Hi, this is Angela Levesque, host of Entanglement Radio. Join me Wednesdays at 12 p.m. Eastern for inspiring conversations with visionaries in spiritual science and conscious healing. Entanglement Radio, Wednesdays at 12 p.m. Eastern. Transcendent talk for the conscious mind.
Have you ever wondered how to change your love paradigm? The secret key is finding a love partnership, not just a regular connection. How do you find these? Through conscious relationships. Ascending Hearts Dating is a dating site for people like you that believes in second chances and a different type of spiritual connection. Try Ascending Hearts for free today at AscendingHearts.com and change your love paradigm. Ascending Hearts, the premier dating community for the spiritually awake. Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio. IOM FM.
Before that we are a republic, and many people don't know that. Many people think that we are a democracy, and there's a difference, and I'd like you to explain that.
Yeah, so it's fascinating to me because in D.C. every 2 years you have a midterm election and some idiot, usually the Speaker of the House, gets up and says, you know, the American people have spoken and they've decided we live in a democracy and they've decided for divided government. And what they mean by that is that one faction controls one lever of the government and another faction controls another. But there's so many problems with that statement. And the first one is that we don't live in a democracy. We live in a republic. The model for the founders of this country was not ancient Athens, which was a true democracy in which everybody voted on everything, or at least the propertied men voted on everything. And so if they want to go to war, everybody voted. If they wanted to raise taxes, everybody voted on discrete policy issues. We don't live in that system. We live in a representative system of government in which you have elements of a monarch in the executive, you have an aristocratic element in the Supreme Court and originally the Senate, and then you have a democratic element in the House of Representatives, which was the weakest form of the weakest branch of government as the founders conceived it. And they did that because they were terrified of democracy. They thought democracy was one of the worst forms of government, second only to tyranny, because they believed that democracy ultimately led to tyranny. And in ancient Athens, democratic Athens was not a peaceful state. It was an imperialist state. It was a warlike state that got into a lot of trouble. And so when the founders were developing our republic, they looked to the Roman Republic and they looked to Sparta as a model, not to Athens.
And so as you look at the way that it is now, actually, no, before I get to that question, let's talk about document. Sir, I'm just fell out of my head. Let's talk about the origins of our government and where it actually originated from, because what was the role of government when it began? Because I think that we have gotten very far from what its original purpose was.
So a lot of the thinking about the American system of government was driven by John Locke in the essay. Sorry, it's escaping me now. I should know it. but concerning the true original extent and end of civil government, and which he was trying to determine what's the role of government, what should the government be for? And really, the animating principle behind our government is the defense of public, the defense of private property is paramount to our system of government. And in Locke, he expresses it as life, liberty, and the pursuit of private property. And Jefferson took that and made it the pursuit of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So private property is at the center of all our political discourse and all of our political system. And the government exists to protect our private property. And that's where you get our individual rights and all this other stuff is from, you know, the defense of our private property rights.
And so do you feel you had this chapter where you start out telling Violet, your daughter, about the events of September 11th. And I was actually living in California during that time. And even as I'm reading the words and remembering that, I'm getting a little bit teared up. And you spoke about we had the opportunity at that moment. And I noticed, too, it was so palpable. It happened on a Tuesday. And the next, I think I didn't have to go to work until the Thursday. And I'm riding to work and it felt different. I was at the grocery store. It was instead of this kind of dog-eat-dog mentality where everyone was so busy and just, you know, they spent – it's California, so they spent hours in traffic and just so busy. And it was so – it was different. It was – people were so willing to help one another. And there was just this kindness and I've got your back kind of mentality instead of dog-eat-dog. And you said something that we had the opportunity then to really – look at the things that we've created, to really look at, you know, why this happened, what was our role. And of course, we didn't. We went in with kind of a bloodlust and thought, okay, how do we eliminate our enemies? And in that day fundamentally changed our government and our rights and all of that. So as we have this conversation, do you feel like we have really jumped ship from the original intent of what government was here to do?
Yes, I think that what's happened now, especially after 9/11, and I should say that I was in that camp. I was scared and terrified. I wanted somebody to do something. I wanted them to catch bin Laden. But what we did was we made a decision to let the government have complete arbitrary power over us. And that is the one thing that you are never supposed to do in our system of government, is allow the government to wield arbitrary power. And so this has gone on so long that mainstream candidates like Hillary Clinton can't even dial back the idea of mass surveillance. Like, we can't even have a conversation about whether or not that's an appropriate thing for the government to be doing. It's such an invasion of our personal our privacy rights. It's a violation of the Constitution. But we're allowing it to go on and on and on because there's this mindset that in times of war, the executive is absolute and they can do whatever they want. And I remember hearing Dick Cheney talk about this on Meet the Press, and he was saying, you know, the president, you know, he was asked about arbitrary detention, of indefinite detention of detainees and, you know, enemy combatants. And he said, the president of the United States has the ability to destroy the world with the press of a button. You're asking me if he has the authority to detain a few enemy combatants. And his point was that our powers are absolute. We can do whatever we want, and there's no recourse whatsoever. That's not legitimate. That's not a legitimate exercise of government power.
No, it's absolutely not. And when we talk about this war on terror, which now is what, in its 15th year or 16th year, we're still not having any of those important conversations. Like, our idea, and this is where I kind of want to bring in some Machiavelli here, at the ends justify the means, although you say he has a deeper meaning to that. But when I'm listening to, you know, conservative talk radio and they're saying, let's just go in and kill all the terrorists. Well, right. That just creates that. I mean, that doesn't even work for once. You're never going to bring peace by more war and violence. Like, that doesn't even make sense in a logical world. But so when you think about this war on terror and you have this whole lineage of, or you have this whole history to look back on, how do you feel we get out of this?
Well, I think there's a pretty widespread recognition that in the country that we made significant mistakes, and that and I think it's true among the policy leaders too. It's what Sanders is hammering Clinton on all the time, and this is such a political conversation. I'm surprised, but I think that we're now in the, like, for instance, we didn't send 300,000 troops to Syria. We didn't get involved in that conflict, and that was the right decision. We didn't do that. And Obama was courageous in not doing that, I think, because there was a lot of pressure for us to get involved there. And so I think that we are getting out of it. I think that people are saying, wait a minute, this isn't okay. We can't let the government do this. This is not appropriate. So I guess it's, you know, some people are pessimistic about it and think that we're going to go down that road, but it didn't happen. You know what I mean? I think that we're pulling back and moving to the left. And the conversation is definitely moving to the left, I feel like.
So there was definitely some undertones of cynicism as I'm reading your book. And do you feel that overall, do you feel positive about where we're going?
Yes, I feel very much. For my daughter, actually, you know, I really feel like her generation is going to have to sort this out. And that's really why I wrote the book. Our generation is not going to do it. We're grinding these gears to a stop now. You know what I mean? And we're forcing the moment to a crisis. That's going to be our role. And my daughter's generation's role is going to be to build and develop the system that's going to work for everybody in an information age. And that's going to be her charge. So I'm optimistic about it. I do think that, frankly, I do believe that things are going to get worse before they get better. but that's sort of true throughout history. You know what I mean? The crises happen and then people sort of figure it out and move forward.
So, you know, the saying that, you know, that history repeats itself and, you know, it just does seem like we always need crisis in order to make different decisions. But it seems that our level of crisis because of our population, I mean, it's going to be 9 billion. And, you know, and looking at the land and the resources and the environment and climate, it seems like our crisis is really large now. And they're much more complex than some of them in the past. Now, maybe this is my perception. Maybe every generation, every thinker was like, look at our foolishness. I don't know, maybe, but it seems to me like they're very big now.
The problems are very big. And that's because what happened in the last century is unprecedented in human history. We had a, you know, our global population went from 1 billion to 7 billion in 100 years. That's crazy. Life expectancy shot through the roof. We've got increased specialization. We've got millions and billions of people living in poverty. We've got a problem with the environment. All these things are true, I think. It's interesting. I took this entomology class in college, and I remember the teacher explaining locust swarms to me. And what would happen is there would be a bumper crop, and then a swarm would arrive, and the swarm would eventually burn itself out, that there was no way nature could sustain it. And I'm not saying that's going to happen, but some tipping point is going to be reached at which we're going to have to seriously address the structural problems that we've now got. The environment is a huge part of that question. But again, technological progress is helping us with that. You see what Elon Musk is doing with portable, storable solar energy. It's amazing. You know what I mean? So we, you know, if we just got off fossil fuels, that would take us a long way to solving the problem. You know what I mean? So,
yes.
So we may innovate our way out of some of it, but other ways we're going to have to, there's going to have to be some radical readjustment. And that's the problem now, is that everybody's thinking in this industrial mindset, and we're not there anymore. We've moved past that. We have to sort of get our heads around that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you said you didn't know that this would be such a political conversation. Well, this show is about potential, human potential and possibilities. And
Oh yeah. I didn't mean anything by it directed at you. I just meant that, you know, because I do deal with politics, and I guess it is a pretty political book, but it's more about the relevance of these thinkers. And you know what I mean? Like, I didn't want to. Yeah. Anyway, go ahead. Sorry. I'm digging a hole.
No. I think it's fascinating, but I wanted to take the opportunity to have some of these conversations around politics. One, because we're in election year, but two, because I think, you know, people will say two things you don't talk about. You don't talk about politics and you don't talk about religion. And I say, we need to talk about politics and we need to talk about religion. We need to open up the conversation and be able. I said the other day that it seems like we live in a perpetually offended society, that everybody has just decided that what their opinion is fact. And if you have a differing opinion, then I must attack you because my opinion can't exist next to yours. And I think you see that on social media. I think you see it in the commentary in our 24-hour news cycles. And we need to have these conversations. We need to open it up so that we talk about justice, that we talk about differing economic ideas, because that's really important as well. So when we get back, we'll just continue this conversation here with Matt Barisi on Entanglement Radio.
Your conscious connection to a more mindful world. Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. Om Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single Om Times endeavor. Host your show with Om Times Radio Network. Join Elliot Jolish, the business therapist, each Tuesday at 5 p.m. Eastern for the Elliot Jolish Hour, as he interviews business experts on your behalf. And you're invited to email your business questions to questions@ecjgroup.com for answers, live, on air, every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Eastern on the Elliot Jolish Hour.
Circle of Hearts Radio is a sanctuary on the airwaves. Join me, Grandmother Elia, in the circle on Sunday, 2 p.m. Eastern, as I share information to both enlighten and nourish your soul.
Have you ever wondered how to change your love paradigm? The secret key is finding a love partnership, not just a regular connection. How do you find these? Through conscious relationships. Ascending Hearts Dating is a dating site for people like you that believes in second chances and a different type of spiritual connection. Try Ascending Hearts for free today at ascendinghearts.com and change your love paradigm. Ascending Hearts, the premier dating community for the spiritually awake. Your conscious lifestyle on steroids. Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
And if you want to find out more about my services, my Inspired and Empowered program, which starts at the end of the month, you can go to HestiaHealth.com, creating calm minds, open hearts, inspired lives. So, Matt, I wanted to know, because you had, you know, a whole group of philosophers and thinkers to choose from. How did you decide which ones were going to make it into your book?
So I didn't decide. So what happened is, in the great books of the Western world, I should say a little bit of what they are. It's a 54 volume set that was curated in the 50s by Robert Maynard Hutchins and Mortimer Adler. And in the back of that book, there's a book called The Great Conversation. And in there, there's a table of contents for 10 years of reading. And this book represents the first year on that reading list. So I went the route that they told me to go, the editors of the set. They didn't say you had to approach it that way, but they said this is a possible approach. And they really did curate it very well, because each reading sort of builds on the last one. And that's what they meant by something called the great conversation, that these writers are in conversation with one another. They are throughout history, throughout hundreds of years and over centuries. Machiavelli's talking to Cicero, Machiavelli's talking to Plato, as if they were contemporaries. So I followed their advice on it, to tell you the truth.
Well, it seems very relevant to today's conversation. It seems like all of the things that, yes, we should be talking about. But when you look at the grand scheme of things, the 1950s wasn't really that long ago. So let's talk about our economics, because one of the things that you bring up is that many economic systems have been tried. And I think that in the same way that humans are short-sighted about our future, I think we're pretty short-sighted about our history as well, and realizing that there has been many things tried. So having your long view of looking at all of these different economic systems, where do you feel the next best place for us to go is?
Oh, I don't know. I guess I could tell you a little bit about what I don't endorse Marx's view of communism, because I don't think that's worked very well in practice. Now, a lot of people would say it's never actually been tried, because you need a period of rampant capitalism before you get into it. But I do think that Marx's indictment of capitalism in the Communist Manifesto is fascinating to read, because he pretty much describes what's going on right now, which is rampant consolidation, outsourcing, mechanization, and where the ruling class is becoming smaller and smaller, and everybody else is left behind. And that's what his indictment of capitalism was, basically, that the imbalance has become so great that it simply becomes absurd and it breaks down. And I think that's what Sanders is talking about out there in the 1%. And I think there's a popular viral video about inequality in America that really shows how bad it's become. And it's pretty striking to see. And part of that is because of the way that when you look at a company like Uber, for example, Uber's market cap is the same as GM. They're both worth about $50 billion. GM has 200,000 employees. Uber has 2,000 employees. So you don't need to be a mathematician to really figure out that it's changing, that the way that capital is generated and shared is changing. So I think the conversation has to be around what it is starting to be around, which is, what is the fair distribution of goods and services? You know, how are we going to deal with this issue? It's a big issue. Smarter men than me, smarter women than me will figure this out. You know what I mean? But I can't, to tell you the truth. I think communism's fatal flaw is that it doesn't take into account individuality. It thinks that individuality is not a thing. And I disagree with that completely.
So then on the other end of the spectrum, we have Adam Smith, who's they've labeled the father of capitalism. What would he think about our system as it is today?
Well, I guess what's fascinating is how much I hear him misquoted. Adam Smith, Adam Smith, I think he would think it has become completely perverted, that when we start to socialize risk and privatize profit, we've gone down a complete rabbit hole, and that has nothing to do with how capitalism was originally designed to work. But the problem with that is that you have to endure, if you're going to do that, you have to endure pain, which we decided not to endure after 2007. We just threw a bunch of money at the problem and bailed a bunch of banks out. But the problem still exists. It hasn't gone away. So I think he would view that our system is quite perverted and not even resembles, doesn't even resemble what he was talking about.
I would totally agree. So we've talked a little bit about the modern philosophers and what they're thinking about. As we, and you talked about universal income, but as we free up all of this time with the inevitable mechanization that's been happening, that will continue to happen, you know, some people are of the camp that people will just want to just sit and loaf around and do nothing. And I guess this gets to some of the fundamental nature of what we believe is, you know, the virtues of the humans. But some people think that we will take that opportunity to really, you know, have time to be more philosophical, to think about the reason why we exist, to enrich our world. Where do you think we fall?
I believe that what you just said is true. I actually think, you know, this is going to sound hopey smiley, but I believe it might look like a Star Trek. You know what I mean? It might look like that kind of a economic model in which there is, you know, I don't know. I'm not a big Trekkie, but I do know that in the Star Trek universe, all these problems have gone away, that there's nobody has to worry about money or anything like that. But there's still a way for people to excel and explore their own personal interests. And there's still a hierarchy of excellence and a meritocracy. And I think that that is what we will move forward towards, hopefully, is a system like that, where people are free to enrich their lives and the lives of everyone else by pursuing their own interests fully.
Well, I hope so too. And it's interesting because I think lots of times people living in America don't really realize that, like you said, a lot of this stuff is already embraced, especially in, you know, Western European nations. And there's a much more, there's still room for individualization, but there's more connection to, you know, the common good. And I just see it's just such a big departure, though, for our current mentality here in the United States, which is kind of individualism at all costs. And I don't know how we get from point A to point B.
Yeah. I wish I knew too. I felt like my job was to sort of lay out how we got here. This is how we got here, because I feel like we're all prisoners in this prison, try to find a way out of the prison, but we don't bother to study the plans of how the prison was built and when the guards are coming and all that other stuff. And if we can see how we got here, we might be able to find out a way out of this mess and think how these people thought.
You know, I've heard some people that it's just like, as soon as all the baby boomers die off, then we'll be able to get down to the business of some real change. And I know that sounds really bad, but there might be a little bit of truth to that, because there is, I mean, when we look at our media, which really directs where our attention goes and really writes the narrative for us, sadly, I think that when we see some of those things, you know, the people at the top of those places fall away, and some of the new people come in who have a little bit more consideration for the collective good and general will, I think I think we have a good shot. So we're almost up here at the end of the show. I really enjoyed our conversation, by the way, but I want to give you plenty of time to share where people can find your books, your website, and anything you'd like to leave my listeners with today.
Sure. Well, the only thing I leave your listeners with is the lesson I learned from Plato, which is that be skeptical. Don't trust what people are telling you. And I think that's the most important lesson I took away from the great books of the Western world, was to constantly be skeptical and be questioning what you're told. And then you can find my books at Amazon, both books, and I'm on Goodreads. You can find me on Goodreads. I'm always happy to answer questions or make a Goodreads friend. And I'm on Facebook, obviously.
So you don't have your own website? And
well, I have Goodreads is my author website. That's what I use. I know I should have a website.
It's good. Like I said, that's the reason why I don't ask a lot of self-help out. Why did you write this? But I don't know. There's a lot of self-serving going on. So I appreciate it when people just, I'm a writer and I'm a thinker, and there's enough experts out there. I got an email newsletter from Daniel Pinchback the other day, and he said, I don't like it when people refer to me as an expert. I'd rather be considered as a thinker or a philosopher, because there's already enough experts out there. And I think it goes to that your last comment there about being skeptical is, There's a lot of people out there with ideas and opinions, but I think it's time to look within and figure out your own. So anyway, I just want to thank you so much for being on the program today. I really, really enjoyed our conversation.
Me too. Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
You too.
All right. So coming up next week, we actually have the blue collar goddess, Sarah Nash, and we are going to have another candid conversation. I've sort of decided that I'm going to have a little bit more of a conversational tone in what I do here, because I think that there's a lot to learn. And yes, it's great to have experts, but like as I said just a couple moments ago, that it's time for us to look within. And so sometimes we can do that just by having those good conversations and being open to hearing ideas, because that closing down of everything is not serving us. Pardon me. I just want to remind you as well that I have an exciting program starting on February 29th called Inspired and Empowered, and it's really all about removing your energetic and mental blocks that are keeping you where you're at. I think that it is time to activate that potential within you. It's time to get excited about your life. I've said before, we don't need consensus right now. What we need is for each person going out there and not tearing down what they don't agree with, but really building up what they love and spending their time and opportunity to do that. So you can find out more about Inspired and Empowered at HestiaHealth.com. You can hear me every Wednesday at 12 p.m. Eastern live right here on the OWN Times Radio Network. Please do find me on Facebook and on Twitter at Hestia Health and Entanglement Radio. And yes, stay tuned. The last Wednesday, I think it's February 24th, we're going to have Del Miguel Ruiz on, the author of The Four Agreements. So great stuff happening here. This is Angela Levesque wishing you love and light. I'll see you next week.
The future of